Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Frank H.T. Rhodes, who is President Emeritus of Cornell University and the 1999 Jefferson Lecturer at the University of California at Berkeley. A geologist by training, Professor Rhodes has published widely in the fields of geology, paleontology, evolution, the history of science, and education. During his 18-year tenure as president, Cornell increased minority presence in its student body from 8% to 28%. The number of women and minorities on the faculty doubled. Student evaluations and advising were added to the tenure process. Research funding tripled from $88 million to more than $300 million, and Cornell undertook new initiatives in Asian studies, supercomputing, biotechnology, and nanofabrication. Cornell also completed a $1.25 billion capital campaign and ended deficit spending under President Rhodes. President Rhodes has also been a national leader in advocating education and research, and he's played a significant role in the development of national science policy under several presidents. Professor Rhodes, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Where were you born and educated?
I was born in England and grew up there. I was educated at Solihull School, which when I went was an all-boys school, an independent school. And that was a terrific educational experience. I wasn't the most outstanding student, but the debt that I have to that school is substantial, not least in the kind of opportunities that it gave for leadership as well as learning. I then went on. I graduated just as World War II ended, so I was at school in England during that war, and then went on to the local university, the University of Birmingham, where I took a couple of degrees.
And you chose geology as your field?
No, I didn't really. I knew almost nothing about what to choose. There weren't such things as college advisors in those days. And my plan had been to go into the regular army. That was no doubt partly the result of the times. But my parents, who were wiser than I was in this, decided that I really should be encouraged to go to college first. And so I decided to go and study chemical engineering. The reason I chose that was that I had got this rather romantic notion of oil engineering, being out in the desert on a rig, and I was very fond of life outdoors. And in the course of that, I happened to take a course on geology, which was a requirement, and fell in love with it, and have been in love with it ever since.
What books did you read as a young person that influenced the choices you were later to make?
Mostly what I had to read. I was not an exemplary student. I was a late bloomer in that sense, but good enough to get by. But from an early age, I enjoyed both literature and science. I probably should never have gone into science, though I had a happy career in it. But I developed a love for words and literature based on, I think, some superb teaching that I was privileged to have in Shakespeare and the Victorian novelists, the English novelists.
Is this before college?
This was before college, yes.
Yeah.
The British system's a little different in that you get heavy doses of one thing, but the downside of that is that you have to specialize very early if you're going to go on to college, or did. Things have changed now. So at age 15 or thereabouts, you decide whether you're going to go into a literature stream or into a science stream or into a pre-medical stream. And that means a great narrowing of horizons at a very early age. I chose science, but I still managed to keep going with some interest in literature.
Were there any important mentors as a young person that you have that you recall to this day?
There were several. And one of the great things about this school to which I went, Solihull School, was that it was small enough, 500 students, to allow you to really develop your own road in life as an individual. Great responsibility was given to the students in terms of the organization of the school discipline. And so I ended up being what was called captain of the school. And that experience of having leadership responsibilities for 500 other boys was really a very important growing experience. And two or three masters at that school were really very important influences in my life, as were a couple of people I had at college as professors.
You then did graduate work or postgraduate work in the United States after you had gotten your degrees in England?
Yes, I did. I was one of the first Fulbright scholars. And so I went to the University of Illinois as a very new PhD. I managed to do a PhD in 2 years in Britain, and that was unusual then, and it's impossible now. But that was a great benefit. So while I was still relatively young, I had the immense good fortune to go to Illinois, which was a totally new experience, a huge, sprawling, wonderful university and a whole new world. And I worked with a great man and a good friend who died just this year, Harold Scott, in paleontology, which was a wonderful experience. He had the good judgment to leave me largely to my own devices, but to open up the possibilities for doing things. And I also had the immense good fortune to meet my wife there, so that it was a very eventful year for me.
So thus far, I've heard you say that away with words, and you learn leadership in these early years in high school. So does this help us understand the transition from professor, faculty member, to administration?
Well, I don't know that I claim I learned leadership. I was given responsibility, and I think that encourages a sense of leadership. But I don't know that any of us ever plans a lifelong career with that kind of precision, and it's only retrospectively that I think you can get a sense of what the reasons were that led you that way. I fell from grace fairly slowly in terms of leaving the pure academic life. I was head of a department for a dozen years or so in Britain, a geology department in the University of Wales. I became a dean over there and got a little exposure, and then went to the University of Michigan as a professor, spending all my time teaching and doing research, but gradually drifted back into administration. And there's a sense, I think, in which these positions seek you out. I don't think I've ever applied for a job in that sense. It's different now. You have to apply for jobs. But an opportunity was offered me to become dean of a very large college at Michigan, the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts, with 20-plus thousand students and 50-plus departments and so on. And that was really when I first got a taste for this, and although I'd never planned to spend the rest of my career doing it, that's pretty much what happened.
How does leadership in a university different from leadership in other sectors of society, or is it the same?
I think it's the same. I think the conditions are a little bit different, but I think the qualities are not dissimilar. And I think the people who succeed, and some of them you know very well here at Berkeley. I had dinner with Clark Kerr last night, mm-hmm. who's the model for all of us in this. But the people who succeed, I think, are people who are passionately committed to what it is they're doing and to the constituency that they're serving. And I've always felt that the university is really one of the most important engines in the development of society, that it plays a crucial role that no other institution does. And that commitment, that balanced but unswerving commitment to the institution you serve, I think is the first element of leadership. But all the other things that go to make a good leader in other fields, whether it's political life or a great corporation or even a congregation, these I think are the same qualities: knowing where you want to go, having a vision of the future of the institution, setting some goals to get there instead of just having a vague notion, picking the people to lead with you, setting the climate for the institution, really being an advocate for the values of the institution and developing that sense of personal engagement, and then finally scrambling together the resources to help you achieve those goals. That's pretty much the same, whatever it is you're leading.
And in your view, in the same way that the You have characterized the university as the engine for society. The president of the university is really an engine for the university.
I believe so. I don't want to be guilty of overstatement, because it would be wrong to pretend that everything depends on the effectiveness of the president. But I believe the best presidents can really be very effective in creating the climate and creating the sense of confidence and hope and expectation, and setting the standard, establishing a benchmark, and that rubs off across the campus, across the alumni. It challenges the governing board. It builds confidence in the public. And so that public role based on personal expectations of distinction and achievement is something that does make a difference, yes.
You've had leadership roles in both private and public universities. Is there a difference there? Do you have to worry about a different set of issues in one as opposed to the other?
There is a difference. I think the principles of leadership are the same. But the great universities of the nation, the publics, the Berkeleys, the Michigans, the privates, the Harvards, the Stanfords, the Yales, the Cornells, I think are becoming more and more similar in many respects rather than continuing in different directions. The publics are becoming more heavily dependent on private funding. And here at Berkeley, you have a $1 billion campaign. Maybe it's more than that now, but it's at least a billion, I know,
yeah.
Which is going wonderfully well. The privates, I think, are becoming more publicly committed and accountable. And I like to think that the old model of the land-grant university is probably going to be where both publics and privates end up. I think the big difference in the private universities is that you have a much greater degree of freedom in terms of setting priorities and being politically independent and in serving the institution without the kind of constraints that go with boards of trustees or regents who are either politically elected, running on a particular ticket, as they are in some states, or appointed by the governor, and in some cases, of course, have multiple constituencies in terms of the different campuses of the system. That makes it a much more cumbersome and less focused and less easy board with which to deal. I've benefited from both boards, but I've no doubt that the opportunities for flexibility and quick decision and achieving the kind of results that are ones that are chosen are much easier in the private side of the house.
Looking back at your tenure at Cornell, what was your most frustrating item on your agenda or disappointing experience as you led that great university?
Well, life was really full of satisfactions rather than frustrations.
Okay.
And so I really did find that 18 years was an incredible honeymoon, and I look on it as just a golden period. So I don't have a massive sense of frustration. I guess if I have any frustration, it's one that everybody shares, I think, who's been in that role, and that is that it takes so long to achieve any particular result. Mm-hmm. I feel very strongly that undergraduate education is one of the most important areas to be taken seriously by the great universities, the great research universities, and yet changing the culture and changing the climate in a way that makes that a priority for everyone is something that takes a long time. Mm-hmm. And you do your best, you use occasions to talk about this, you teach classes yourself, you advise freshmen yourself, you provide incentives for doing this, but it changes slowly, and to that extent, I think most of us feel a certain measure of frustration.
And what is the obstacle there, if I may ask?
It's the culture of the campus.
Mm-hmm.
It's the desire to excel in areas of scholarship, which is praiseworthy and wholly understandable, and the fact that the day is still limited to 24 hours, and the good can sometimes crowd out the better. And we all know that. Life is becoming harder, I think, for the typical faculty member, scrambling for grants, struggling with the explosive growth of knowledge required in many public institutions to be ever more accountable to various government agencies. I understand very clearly the burdens that are placed on members of the faculty.
In your lecture yesterday, and we will be talking about this as we go along, you identified changes in undergraduate education as really one of the major challenges facing the American university in the next millennium.
I think that's right. The present situation is that we've got 13 or 14 million students enrolled on our campuses. And for most of those, the ultimate degree will be a baccalaureate degree. What we haven't really done, especially on the research campuses, is to reach any kind of agreement as to what the purpose of that degree is. Mm-hmm. Nor have we reached agreement, I think, as to what the purpose of the PhD degree is, for example. And it seems to me the most important challenge that we face as faculty members of institutions is to sit down and debate that issue. What is the purpose of an undergraduate education, not globally, but here on my own particular campus?
One of the challenges that we face in California is this question of affirmative action, that is, who will be the undergraduate students. That's a problem that you had to address at Cornell and did so in quite a successful way. What lessons did you learn that might be relevant to the current discussion about affirmative action?
I don't presume to have anything to offer California. The state doesn't need, the university doesn't need my help. They've great experience and great wisdom available to them, and so I don't presume to comment on the situation here. In my own case, though, I think the most important question to be addressed was the need to take this as a serious challenge. And so I chaired a national commission on this topic that had some influence, some useful influence. I referred to it frequently on the campus. And the challenge, I think, on a particular campus, any campus, is to make sure that this isn't just the business of the administration. It isn't just a few people struggling in the central office whose objective is to improve enrollment and retention, but it's everybody's business. Everybody's, every faculty member's business in every department, every admissions officer in every college. And getting that sense of mutual commitment is something that takes time. But we had good results, and I hope they can go on getting better. There is a challenge in California, obviously, but the present need is to find ways of going ahead with that commitment, even in the face of the fact that traditional methods are no longer acceptable.
I hear you saying that again and again, is that the challenge is really to have a vision, to have goals, for example, with regard to affirmative action, but really work with people.
That's basically right.
Yeah.
I think that's the secret. And you know, that's going to be true for affirmative action. It's very clear that we have to have a system of higher education which provides equal access for all our people. And that unless we have that, we shall be impoverished as a nation. It's not only a question of justice in terms of the access of individuals. The nation needs that kind of participation. And so there has to be a way to make it possible. And if the old ways are no longer available, we must find new ones so that all will participate. And maybe not every institution is going to participate in exactly the same way, but the vision, shared and acted on together, that has to persist.
Did 18 years is a long time to be the head of any organization. How did the problems of managing the university change during that tenure, or did it?
I think it did change. I suppose there are many ways it changed. The two that come to mind, which are probably the most conspicuous, were first of all the financial one. Cornell had acquired a habit of deficit spending, where each year's budget was out of balance, and it turned to the endowment more and more frequently for more and more support in ways that eroded the long-term health of that. I decided we had to stop that, and so we did that, put the brakes on, and that was very unpopular, very painful. But it did the trick. because you cannot go to foundations and donors unless you can assure them that you're behaving responsibly and that you have a financial plan which is a prudent one. So that was a painful change early on, but it's one that has now become part of the fabric of managing the university. The second one, I think, that is important in retrospect, and I felt was important at the time, was that the university that I found had somehow lost confidence in itself. Cornell had a very tough time in the late 60s, very tough.
Because of the dissent?
Because of the dissent. Yeah, right. That had split the faculty down the middle, it had split the alumni. It had lost confidence in itself. It was made up of faculty people who were rather resentful that they weren't Harvard or Yale. They happened to be Cornell instead. It was made up of students who felt that they just missed getting into Princeton, and so they'd had to settle for Cornell. I think one of the most important opportunities was to present Cornell not as something close to Harvard or Berkeley, but as something in its own right that was distinctive and that had a certain quality and a certain ethos, and to share that sense of confidence and pride with other people on the campus. I think over the years, people felt that they could take the world on and win on their own terms. And I think that's an important role of leadership.
You were responsible for a number of initiatives in new areas, Asian studies, supercomputing, biotechnology, and so on. Give us one as an example and how you chose to move in that direction and what was involved in mobilizing support to do that.
Well, maybe take a couple of those. The first one, Asian studies. Cornell had a strong tradition of Asian studies. Some of the earliest students came from China. Some of the earliest scholars had an interest in Asian affairs and literature. And so that seemed a natural area to try to pull together to make some progress. And we did it by strengthening faculty numbers and faculty appointments in those areas. We did it also by beginning to take a much closer interest in Asia. And so I traveled to Asia maybe, 10 or maybe more times during the years that I was there, building contacts with Asian universities, getting to know Asian alumni, building bridges with Asian government agencies and corporations. I think all that helped and continues to help. It so happens that one of our alumni was president of Taiwan, and so that was a natural kind of linkage and interest. The other one was biotechnology, where I'm bound to say we haven't done nearly as well as the University of California system has done, for reasons that I don't find myself able to say clearly what they were. But it was very
Maybe
clear.
Maybe the weather.
that always may have something to do with it. In fact, you know, the early movies were made in Ithaca. So the term cliffhanger refers to the cliffs all around the Ithaca campus and these gorges. But gradually, that moved west because of the weather. And we lost that to California. But it was very clear that biotechnology was up and coming. And we put an institute together, a center for biotechnology, built a new building, built some corporate contacts. I don't think that's done as well as certainly I'd hoped. And the other reason, perhaps, was that our medical school is 250 miles away from the campus. It's in Manhattan. And so we've got another campus downtown in New York City. And there was never the kind of interchange there that might have linked the clinical development of these products to their creation. I hope we can make up for lost time, but I think that was an initiative that started well but hasn't fulfilled some of its promise.
Looking at the university today, is a university education still a crucial means to the implementation of the American dream for the individual?
I think it is, because the American dream assumes the equality of opportunity. Although we're committed to a belief that all are created equal, we know in fact that they're not created with equal opportunities, even now, in spite of all the progress we've made. And so in a world where the key driving force, the new economic currency, is knowledge and access to knowledge. That's going to become more important rather than less important. Knowledge is not going to replace all the other things that have been economically important, natural resources and transportation webs and climate, as you've just pointed out, and population size and distribution. All those things are still important. But knowledge just breaks all the old categories. And now the industries that are ones with a future and the great profits are knowledge-based industries, communications, biotech, materials among them, all those things. Low employment, but high knowledge content. And that's going to put a premium on nations and regions with outstanding research universities, because it's those universities that create more than far more than 50% of the basic research that are responsible for it. They create the knowledge, they apply that knowledge, they share it between their members, they test it through extension systems, they spread it throughout their own states and regions. That's going to be something that's a winning combination, I think.
Do you feel that the university is threatened at all by the new information technologies, even as it is contributing to the development of so much of the technology?
Yes, maybe threatened is a strong word, but I think the new information technology, as you say, developed by universities themselves in many cases, is both an opportunity, chiefly an opportunity, but it's also a threat if we insist that the only way for universities to operate is the old traditional pattern. The old traditional pattern that all of us grew up with and we feel very comfortable with is one which required a huge campus with a massive library, very extensive facilities, not just for seminars and lectures and meetings and all the rest, but for the sciences and for technology. The new learning opportunities are going to involve access from anywhere on Earth, literally, at any time of day. So the location is less important. Timing is much less important. The notion that you've got to have 4 years with two semesters, 16 credit hours a semester, has gone. It will now be knowledge on demand of a certain kind, picked literally on the basis of personal choice and convenience. And all the traditional patterns of the role of the professor, the method of teaching, the content of knowledge, the style of participation, all those things are undergoing modification. You yourself have a program which is demonstrating how effective the new technology can be, both in outreach and in inreach. But it really changes the culture of learning, and it changes the culture of teaching. And most universities, I think, have not really aroused themselves to those new possibilities.
One of the things you mentioned in your lecture yesterday was the loss of monopoly power that universities had. Tell us a little of that, because it also relates to this information revolution we're going through.
Yes. Well, universities are almost a millennium old, of course. And they've existed since the University of Bologna was established by papal bull, a papal proclamation licensed to provide teaching and certification of degrees. And that's been the pattern, not always from a papal source, but the authorization of the ability to teach and to grant degrees, the chartering of the ancient European universities, and the accreditation of universities in this country has really authenticated the right to give degrees. And that's been very jealously guarded. It's also been recognized that we should police ourselves in terms of the content of that and the standard of that. And so the accreditation is self-accreditation from associations of universities that literally develop their own standards. But if you think about it, that privilege of granting degrees carries enormous responsibility. Admission to medical school, admission to law school, admission to almost every kind of professional practice and examination and profession is based on the certification that universities provide. And that's about to disintegrate, that's about to disappear, because the industry, if I can call it that, is becoming deregulated. And what we're going to see is all kinds of institutions, including for-profit institutions, now providing access to knowledge.
And university extensions are actually becoming more important in this regard also, aren't they?
Yes. I think they've been the poor relation, typically, on a university campus. I think in the future, in fact, in the present, we're seeing them become more important and becoming something of a model and a mentor for the more established traditional areas of the campus, because they're used to the kind of outreach. They're comfortable with the tools that the new information technology provides.
Now, are we in danger of losing the moral dimension that education on a university campus provides, especially a liberal arts college like Cornell, in this new technology age, which delivers skill, training for competency, and so on?
I think there are challenges there, and you may be right that we're in danger of losing it. You know, not everybody believes that a liberal arts education is necessarily the path towards virtue. If you read John Henry Cardinal Newman, he's very insistent that there's a huge difference between what he calls knowledge and what he calls virtue, good behavior. I love that Will Rogers comment that a simple man may steal from a freight train, but give him a college degree and he'll steal the whole railroad. So there's a link, however perverse, between knowledge and behavior. But I agree with your comment. I think over the years, what has been one of the fringe benefits of a traditional education is that life on the campus has encouraged students to think deeply and rigorously about ethical issues, about the great overarching issues of life. And I think two or three things have encouraged that. One has been the humanities, which have been devoted to these great common questions of human experience and to a variety of methods of exploring them and grappling with them. Another has been the role of the faculty as mentors. We've all had professors whom we look up to as models, who've really been people who've influenced our own sense of fairness and justice and standards of behavior and standards of scholarship. And then I think the campus community itself has shaped most of us. Simply having the privilege of living in a society where people come from dozens of different backgrounds and nations and persuasions and getting along together with them, seeking to live creatively and productively together, I think that's been a moral influence. Now, all those three things are diluted in the new world of distance learning and information technology. And so I think to that extent it is a challenge to see how that's going to be replaced in the brave new world.
Throughout your lecture yesterday, and implicit in what you're saying now, is the need for universities to adapt, to be flexible with changing times. Let's talk a little about what changes are necessary. You've suggested that there'll be a convergence between private and public universities. Presumably then our political leaders, our state governments, are going to have to rethink the role of education and the role of universities in where we're going.
I think that's right, and I hope that's going to happen. Most universities, most university systems are operating now on the basis of studies that were done 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, including California, not quite 40, but a long time ago, 20 plus years, as I recall it. And that's going to mean that our present operating arrangements are based largely on a system that has disappeared and on a set of assumptions that have now been modified in very important ways, on a population that has changed and on a population trend that is very different from one that we knew to exist 20 years ago. That means, I think, that the kind of ad hoc planning that most states do for their public universities is not going to serve us well, and that what we need most, this is much easier said than done, is an opportunity for each state to think about the role of higher education in its own life as a state, in the life of its people, in the economy of the state, in the relationship with other sources of learning and instruction, in relation to things as different as public health and environmental conservation and economic development and international trading. In all these ways, the university, the public universities, have a major impact on the everyday life of their states. That's an investment that's recognized in the very existence of the universities. But it's an area that really needs, it cries out for re-examination, for the kind of aspirations that our own futures involve in the state are also going to involve the future of the public universities. It would be wonderful to say we should have a national debate on the same thing, but I think that's almost impossible to undertake, and that the real unit for discussion is the state, or perhaps the region. Maybe the Pacific region is one that's worth thinking about. I don't know if that debate is taking place in California, but it's one that clearly would provide benefits for the state and its people.
I think most of the time it tends to be bootlegged behind other issues or as part of other issues,
yes,
such as affirmative action.
Yes.
The controversy is not generated because there isn't a controversy yet to,
yes,
sit down and talk about the
role.
Well,
a perfect example is the 10th campus, mm-hmm, for the University of California system. I don't know what analysis went into that and what long-term thinking went into it, not only as to the role the system as a whole should play, mm-hmm, but of the particular and distinctive role of the 10th campus. But it would be a lost opportunity if some very serious analysis didn't precede decisions, even though the location is worked out, precede decisions about the nature and the development of that particular campus. Because in many ways, the pattern that emerges from California is the pattern that's going to be adopted by the rest of the country.
Interestingly enough, David Gardner participated in this series, and we actually talked about, and there was a lot of systematic planning with regard to the campus, but then a number of state crises emerged, including the budget crisis of a few years back, which prevented any action, you know, on that. Now, I would presume also that the campuses themselves have to begin to rethink their goals and values as we head into this new millennium.
I think the hardest thing for any president and for any campus is to state clearly, so that you and I could understand it as visitors from another place, what it is it's doing. What is its mission? What is the vision it has for itself? Where it's going in the next 10 years? Now, all of us, myself included, I think, have assumed that you can just keep the machinery going and things will turn up, things will work out, things will develop. And that's true, they do. No one invented the universities in their present form. They kind of grew into it as opportunities came along. But unless we have some clear sense of where an institution wants to go, we shall blunder hopelessly forward. I'm reminded of Yogi Berra saying, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And the opportunities are so great that universities are liable to do that unless there's some very careful thought, some serious reflection about the kind of future for Berkeley and UCLA and Cornell and all the other great institutions.
And the future presidents of these places are going to have to, in some cases, decide not to have certain programs, not to specialize in certain areas.
That's right. I think the day has gone when every university could do everything. I said yesterday that I think the 20th century has been marked by every campus, and we've got 3,800 and something of them, attempting to mimic Harvard. Even the two-year places and the four-year places, all going through this Harvardization process. I think the future belongs to those campuses which are skilled in de-Harvardizing themselves, away from any single model of comprehensive engagement. into areas of importance to them, of significance to their region, and ones where they can make a difference. Now, you'll still need some basics on any campus. You need people who are literate and numerate and all the rest, and you need a certain core of disciplines for that to be possible. But not every campus should look like the one 50 miles away from it. There should be a strong encouragement to differentiation, and there should be a strong encouragement in that sense to partnership of different kinds. And that will not be easy to understand or to develop, because there'll be controversy that surrounds it. If we're not doing it, somebody else is, and that will look as though we've given something away. If we have a partnership with industry, let's say, there will be speculation that we're giving something up by that we're losing an element of freedom. But we have to learn to live with this new pattern of partnership, I think, in creative and manageable ways.
In your overview of the future of universities yesterday, I think in a very gentle and kindly manner, you were handing out grades to the undergraduate and PhD curriculum, and I think you gave a less than a perfect score. Comment on that. What sorts of changes or rethinking needs to happen in those two different curriculums?
Well, I gave a very good score, a kind of A, or in these times of inflated grades, maybe an A plus, for some things, for research, where I think the universities have been preeminent. They're literally the models for the rest of the world. To professional education, which I think has been outstanding in engineering and architecture and agriculture and law and medicine, and you could go on and on. In outreach, I think that one of the great successes of the last 150 years is the extension program and the land grant pattern. I think in terms of undergraduate studies, on the undergraduate experience on the research university campus, we've been much less successful. There's that old cynical definition that a university becomes the college becomes a university when the faculty cease to care about the students, and that has enough edge in it, enough truth in it, really to be a warning to us, I think. And the trouble is, we've grown so big with undergraduate enrollments of 20,000 on the bigger campuses, 30,000 on some of the campuses, that the kind of individual attention that an undergraduate enjoyed during earlier years is something that's increasingly infrequent. It's rare now for people to look back with a sense of nostalgia at two or three great professors who knew them by name. When I was at Cornell, occasionally a student I'd got to know would ask me to give them a reference for graduate school or medical school, and I would always say, well, I don't know you that well, and although I'd be glad to do it, I really don't feel that I'm able to say very much about your intellectual readiness for this. Why don't you get a professor to do it? And very occasionally they'd say, you know, I don't know any professor as well as I know you. Now, that was worrisome for people who'd invested $100,000 and 4 years of their life or longer or more and still didn't feel they were sufficiently well known as individuals to have a professor write in support of their qualifications. And that, if that's bad at Cornell, then it's even worse at a bigger campus with a lower faculty-to-student ratio. And I think that's been one of the casualties of the great success that we've had in research and scholarship and growth in numbers, that we've lost the kind of individual transaction that higher education represented. And we've got to recapture that. And you're doing it wonderfully at Berkeley with the freshman seminar program. I was told just at lunch today that by next year, I think, every freshman will have the opportunity for a freshman seminar experience. That's terrific, and it comes from faculty volunteers who are willing to do this. That's a wonderful refutation of this cynical definition of a university as being too busy to care for its undergraduates.
And part of the problem also lies with the incoherence with regard to what to take. What should be the focus of study? As the world has gotten more and more complex, hasn't it really become much more confusing about which direction one should go in the courses one takes?
I think that's right. I think two things have happened. One is that undergraduate education has become more and more professionalized or pre-professionalized. The pre-med curriculum has had a terrible effect upon the undergraduate curriculum, even of people who are not themselves pre-meds, because it's narrowed it and quantified it and squeezed it into a scientific mold in an unhealthy way. The other thing that's happened is that we have given up any agreement as faculties as to what an undergraduate education should provide. And so I think one of the challenges of the university is to recapture the undergraduate curriculum. What we do is hand people a catalog, an inch thick or more, and say, here are 4,000 wonderful courses. Just pick two in the humanities and two in the sciences and all the rest, and then major in something, and we'll pat you on the head 4 years later and give you a diploma, without any agreement, without even a debate amongst ourselves as to what the substance of that undergraduate experience should be. I think it's irresponsible if we continue to neglect that opportunity. I'd love to write a student bill of rights. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't presume to write it for other places, but I'd love the faculty to decide to write a student bill of rights that students could expect certain things, to be guided sensitively by faculty members, to be challenged by high intellectual standards, to be examined, to be evaluated in ways that are balanced and coherent, to be given the opportunity for cooperative group studies, to be given an opportunity to participate in the great opportunities of campus life and public service. You could put a student bill of rights together that would do much to add, I think, to the richness of the undergraduate experience.
Let's talk a minute about the PhD. Yesterday you were citing figures of the attrition rates from a study by President Rubenstein, I guess, that they were very high. Any? Would you like to share any thoughts with us about the PhD degree program and the kind of rethinking that's necessary?
Well, that's one of the other incomplete grades that I'd give. I'm tempted to give a B minus or something, but you know there's a phrase in the old Anglican prayer book that talks of the praise for what they call time for amendment of life. And I think that's what the universities deserve an incomplete for. I think we have problems with the PhD. That's really the apex of the university's educational program. It's the high point of what we try to achieve in our students. And yet it's in serious disarray. It varies enormously, not just from institution to institution, but from college to college and department to department, even from faculty member to faculty member. And it's very clear that it depends on funds that are themselves undependable, in that they vary from year to year. We lose fellowships here and lose grant support there, and so the students depend on a very unstable source of support. It's also clear that there is a huge difference between the disciplines in terms of time to degree. It takes much longer on average for a degree in the social sciences and humanities than it does for one in the sciences and technology, for example. And there are good reasons for that in some ways. It may be that in a humanities thesis you have to learn a new language, for example. In international studies, same kind of thing. You need different skills. But there isn't much excuse for a degree to take 11 years in philosophy, let's say, as opposed to 4 years or 5 years in physics. What's interesting about that is first of all, that the time to degree has increased over the years. It's about 10% longer now than it was 15 years or so
ago. For all degrees?
Well, especially, it's especially true in the humanities and social studies. Mm-hmm. It's less true in engineering and the sciences. And the other thing is, when you give incentives to finish, either in the form of a carrot or a stick, if they don't finish, the time to degree goes down, and people do complete it in time. By a carrot, I mean the kind of Mellon Fellowship program, which gives dissertation grants and helps people to concentrate on writing. And by stick, I mean the kind of thing that Yale has done, where it's limited the amount of time you can continue to be a TA or a research assistant. And the other thing, as you mentioned, is the fatality rate. These are the best people we graduate. These are Phi Beta Kappa, they're 4-point averages, they're people who are the leaders of their classes. And yet, as you look at the attrition, 50% of those who enroll in PhD programs, the best and the brightest, do not complete the degree. And you may say that's no bad thing. It's very rigorous. It's much tougher than medical school, which has only a 5% attrition, or law school, which is about the same. That's right. It's true. But it's still a shocking failure rate, because it is a failure. It's a failure for someone to achieve a degree on which they'd set their purpose. I spoke to someone last night who was a Cornell alumnus who came to speak at me at the end of the lecture. And I asked him what he was doing, and he said he was working as a computer specialist on campus. I said, that's very good. I'm glad to hear that. Did you do that as soon as you left Cornell? He said, no. I came and spent 4 years doing all the coursework for a PhD in X department, we'll call it. But I completed it, did well, but I became totally disillusioned with what that involved. And I just decided I was going to do something else. Now, I think the figure is 25% drop out during the first year or at the end of it. Another 35% drop out before completing the coursework. And of those who complete the coursework, 25% more drop out without completing the dissertation. And that's a huge wastage of talent and time. So I think we have work to do with a PhD.
Looking back now, as we come to the towards the end of our interview, your great successes at Cornell, you have a real sense of the problems and opportunities confronting the university in the future. Do you think universities in general will be able to do all this rethinking, adjust to pressures from their external environment, and still retain their remarkable identity and integrity and the role that they have performed and that we've talked about?
I hope so. I think we must all hope so. Not all will survive, I think. I think some at the bottom end of the group are going to face very tough competition from distance learning, from for-profit institutions, the University of Phoenix and other places, which treat knowledge as a commodity. But I think the great institutions, and I mean by that not just the great universities, but the great liberal arts colleges, are going to emerge stronger than ever. And I think the dependence of the nation on them, the need for their services, is going to be greater than ever. I don't pretend that's going to be easy. I think there are hard times ahead and hard rethinking that's going to be needed. And there'll be a premium on bold leadership and thoughtful analysis and faculty flexibility. We as faculty members are not the most flexible people in the world. Faculty members have been defined as someone who thinks otherwise. And nothing on some campuses should ever be done for the first time. I think it's going to be difficult to retain the kind of rigidities that we've sometimes cherished in the past. But if we're flexible and creative, and if we take seriously the notion that our scholarship is a public trust and the teaching we provide as a moral vocation and not just the dispensing of information, then I think we shall see that the service we provide is going to continue to be important and to be valued.
One final question. In addition to helping students with the first draft of the Bill of Rights, which you were discussing earlier, what advice would you have for students to get the most out of their education?
Education, like life, is strictly a do-it-yourself job. It's not a spectator sport. You know, there's an old description, which isn't so frequently used now, that John Smith or Mary Kim received his or her education at Stanford or Berkeley. The notion that you receive it passively is just a total falsehood. Education is something you create for yourself. You can no more receive it than you can receive a career. You have to create it for yourself. And the student who prospers will be one who's endlessly inquisitive, endlessly curious, endlessly persistent in pursuing faculty members, in mining information from every source, from reaching out to the richness of experience that campus life provides. This generation seems to me a generation that's very capable and wonderfully effective in doing that.
Professor Rhodes, President Rhodes, thank you very much for joining us today for this conversation about universities and their future. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.